The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, are we really living in that last generation which will see the second coming of Jesus Christ? And if so, does that mean all the other stuff? We can first expect the Antichrist and the seven-year tribulation. Well, my friend, Jesus said no man knows the day or the hour of his return. But understand this, we don't have to be the last generation to experience trials and persecution as Christians. And it doesn't have to be a seven-year tribulation to be tribulation enough. Look what's going on in Iraq. Do you think they need a great tribulation to have greater troubles than they're having now? And don't kid yourself, it could happen in America too. We're far from it. On the road, I believe. Definitely on the road. Sometimes all we need is a president with total disrespect for the law, unless it's a law he makes up himself. House Speaker John Boehner took Democrats to task last month for insinuating that House Republicans want to impeach President Obama. Now, Boehner described the rumor as a scam started by Democrats at the White House, and he said, and I'm quoting him, "This whole talk about impeachment is coming from the president's own staff and coming from Democrats on Capitol Hill. Why? Because they're trying to rally their people to give money and to show up in this year's election." Boehner added, "We have no plans to impeach the president. We have no future plans." Democratic campaign organizations have barraged their base with emails warning about probable impeachment attempts and are using the rumor to raise money. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee also sent reporters an email with a subject line reading, "House Republicans refuse to rule out impeachment." This was literally minutes before Boehner spoke. The strategy proved to be quite effective. 2.1 million in online donations were reported over just one weekend in the month of July. Boehner insists the talk is nothing but a political maneuver, and conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer agrees. While discussing the matter with Brett Baer on Special Report, Krauthammer described the suggestion that House Republicans want to impeach President Obama as a concoction of Democrats. He also called the Democrats desperate, and I'm quoting Krauthammer right now. "They know that in 1998, the party was saved the sixth year of an administration. It was saved by impeachment, overreaching on impeachment by Republicans. And this is a good issue. It's a good way to raise money." But talking about impeachment may only be part of the Democratic strategy. Putting out bait could be the other piece. In the midst of all this impeachment talk, there's a rumor afloat about another of President Obama's infamous executive orders. The exact plan is not yet known, but Obama has stated an intention to use his phone and pen on our immigration system. After hearing that the Republican-controlled House would not go along with a comprehensive rewriting of U.S. immigration law this year, the president gave an impassioned speech claiming he was ready to do what Congress refuses to do and fix as much of our immigration system as we can. Could this be a way of baiting Republicans into impeachment proceedings? Well, conservative talk show host Michael Medved warns Republicans not to take any kind of bait at all. Like Krauthammer, he believes it will backfire and help Democrats hold on to the Senate this fall. He also thinks it will make things easier for future presidents to flex their muscles without fear of impeachment. This makes a lot of sense. The Democratic trap is fairly obvious, and Republicans would be wise to ignore all hooks in the water if they wish to win the political chess game going on. But sadly, this ignores a rather big elephant in the room, namely this. President Obama deserves to be impeached many times over. Yeah, the attempt may be a disaster politically, but sometimes people are called to simply do the right thing, regardless of consequences, regardless of politics. Any one of Obama's many, 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 many scandals and accompanying lies rise to the level of impeachable offense. Two irrefutable ones are the lie he told about being able to keep our own health insurance and the Benghazi video story made up to win an election where he campaigned on the demise of Al-Qaeda. But it's not going to happen. Even if it were believed that the Senate would confirm a House impeachment vote, few Republicans want to go down in history as having impeached the first African-American president. This unique distinction has made Obama virtually invulnerable. Someday, people will remember Martin Luther King's words about character being more important than skin color. History of books will show how President Obama's character came up short and stayed in power only because his adversaries were cowards. Savvy political cowards, perhaps, but cowards nonetheless. But not everybody is a coward where Obama's concerned. Others are just blind. How sad that we live in a society where so few recognize an impeachable offense. Is Obama really that much of a Pied Piper? Yeah, he is, with some help from the mainstream media and college professors. I remember back when Obama was so popular with college students back in the election of 2008. I heard many people my own age saying, you know, we should listen to our youth. Youth knows best. The kids could tell you. The kids know best. No, they don't. Not necessarily, and hardly ever at all. I didn't object diddly squat when I was in college, but I thought I knew everything. In any event, this isn't a generational issue. It's a values issue, an educational issue. It all depends on what our youth are being taught by our 60s counterculture baby boomer professors. And of course, the naive blindness goes beyond students. I meet people my own age all the time who have no business voting because they're uninformed. But Bob, it's my right to vote. Yeah, you have a right to vote, but you also have an obligation to use that privilege responsibly. If you haven't been following the news, if you don't know what's going on in the world, do us all a favor. Don't vote. Stay home this fall. I can only hope that come midterm election day this fall, the same ignorance that brought Obama into power will keep people from figuring out where the polls are. Hey, can you tell me where the polls are? You know, the ones with those far-out hippity-dippity ballots. Maybe they'll all be too drunk on wine or too stoned to find them. Yes, the 60s are still here. One brings to mind those words from the fifth dimension. Oh, sweet blindness.
Sweet, I'm blind, that's good to me.
believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach us through Facebook, Twitter, or directly questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. A few weeks ago on the program, we talked about why Jesus actually does belong in our public schools, contrary to what you're always saying. Dave writes me and says this: religion doesn't really belong in school unless you go to a religious school. You can debate semantics all day long, but it's irrelevant at the end of the day. Not only that, but two other things. One, the idea that Yeshua is a historical figure is highly debatable. Anyone who actually understands the history of Christianity knows this very, very well. Two, Yeshua himself said to essentially keep your religion to yourself. Do people just ignore that part? Well, Dave, maybe you mean well, and I'm sure you're a nice guy, but I must say, that was a very ambitious comment. You aren't just wrong about some of your points, you're wrong about every single point you made. Unless we want to count your tactic of calling Jesus Yeshua. I see you went out of your way to call Jesus by his Hebrew name. Yes, Yeshua is his Hebrew name. I'm wondering if this is Dave's way of showing me how much he knows about real history. He knows the true name of Jesus. Nice try, Dave, but I'm not exactly falling out of my chair just because you used Jesus' Hebrew name, and for a very good reason. Nothing else that you said about Jesus was even remotely true. I would rather you understood the man and the message a little better. If not, the original language of his name makes no difference whatsoever. Dave, where in our Constitution does it say that religion doesn't belong in schools unless they're religious schools? Our Constitution says no such thing. It says the government will not interfere with the free expression of religion. Banning discussion anywhere is interference. As for Jesus not being a historical figure, and you're saying anybody who understands the history of Christianity knows this, that comment not only smacks of arrogance, it ironically betrays the fact that your arrogance is completely unfounded. It shows us that you know absolutely nothing about the history of Christianity and therefore should not be so smug in your arrogance. Although I must confess that doesn't surprise me because you know nothing about our Constitution either, and that didn't keep you from making comments. If historians in Jesus' day recorded that he lived, which they did, then there is as much historical evidence for Jesus as any other figure in the ancient world written about by historians. These talking points about Jesus can be found on atheist websites where the idea that Jesus didn't really exist is gaining in popularity. Chances are that's where Dave read about it. Only one problem with this theory. It is backed up by zero facts and therefore is dismissed by most serious first century scholars. The idea was first made popular by a man named Rudolf Bultmann, and his peers have long since discredited them. And now, speaking of evidence, it does work both ways. I must offer evidence to support my words, too. And Dave, it would be unfair to you if I said on the air that you know nothing about Christianity without backing up my claim. Therefore, with all due respect, I am going to demonstrate to my audience that you are misrepresenting Jesus. Sorry, my friend, you're the one making the outrageous claims about what all serious students of history know. Words like that just cry out to be tested. So, Jesus said to keep our religion to ourselves. Where, Dave? Where exactly did he say that? He said one time that if you're going to brag about your prayer, you might want to pray in private, but keep the religion to yourself. Where do you find that? I'll give you a hint. It's not there. No such words of Jesus exist. In fact, he said the opposite in Matthew chapter 28, where he commanded his disciples to take his message to the entire world. That's quite a bit of telling people to keep it to themselves, to take it to the entire world. In fact, those words could not possibly be more the opposite of what you are claiming. He said here, I'll quote it. Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 through 20. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. See? Now, Jesus didn't tell us to force the religion on people. He didn't command a jihad, but he did command us to at least share the message and then leave it up to the individual. But you have to love Dave's logic. Probably Jesus didn't even exist. Anybody who's truly studied history knows that he probably didn't even exist at all. But if he did exist, then clearly he said the kinds of things about religion, which coincidentally agrees with my belief that religion should be kept to yourself. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't want to believe in Jesus, if you don't want to become a Christian, don't. Who's making you? Who's telling you what to believe? Not me. It's your own business. It's between you and God. But don't go misrepresenting the religion. If you want to express disagreement, at least understand what you're disagreeing with. At least know what you're talking about. I actually have a great respect for honest skeptics. If you follow this show, you've heard me converse with many of them over the year. Most of them very friendly, respectful discussions. But when people talk arrogantly, and in their arrogance misrepresent their opposition, I find that less than honest. It's disingenuous, and I need to call you on it. On the other hand, Dave, perhaps you didn't mean to come across as arrogant. And maybe your arrogance is unintentional. Maybe you heard some things about Jesus and it never occurred to you to check it out. Okay, fine. Now you can check it out. That's all. Thanks for writing in, Dave. Now, this next comment is from Dave. Another Dave, not the same Dave. I guess this is the day of Daves, and yet maybe they're cousins, because this Dave is similar in the sense that he too is displaying an arrogance matched by ignorance, but he's responding to a whole different message. He's responding to the written version of my case that I just mentioned in our monologue that Obama should be impeached. And of course, he brings George Bush into it. Big surprise. Here's Dave's comment about Obama. Beats the hell out of the warmongering fascist imbecile who preceded him. Whoa, Dave, you sure showed me. Putting aside the tired tactic of playing the George Bush wild card whenever one is unable to answer for Obama, putting aside the fact that this Blame George Bush song has had more performances than Les Miserables, it would be nice if people understood what a word like fascism actually means before carelessly tossing it around. One of the definitions of fascism offered by Merriam-Webster Dictionary is this: a tendency toward or actual exercise of strong autocratic or dictatorial control. When a president openly admits that he will sign an executive order simply because Congress won't pass the kinds of laws he wants, that is a tendency toward dictatorial control. When a government tells its citizens that they are going to buy a product such as health insurance, whether they want it or not, that also smells like fascism. When companies are told to supply health care for their employees, even coverage for certain types of birth control, which might violate a religious conviction that was previously upheld in our Constitution's First Amendment, that too is autocratic rule. when a government lies about an attack such as we had on Benghazi, saying it was a result of a video, and arrests the person who made the video, claiming the arrest was for parole violations in a land that's supposed to protect free speech, all the while bragging to the parents of the victims that he wasn't really arrested for parole violations, but was arrested for insulting Muslims. Well, them. Fascism once again rears its ugly little head. Fascist. Is President Obama a fascist? Now, let's be fair. There's a huge difference between Obama and Mussolini. Their names are spelled completely different. But while we're on the subject, we should remember that fascism often comes into power and stays in power by pitting rich against poor and calling for a redistribution of wealth, such as candidate Obama did when he said openly to a plumber at a public meeting who felt he was being taxed too much, "I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody." Often, wealth redistribution is referred to not as fascism, but rather socialism. Descriptions such as fascist are reserved for a regime like Hitler and the Nazis, and yet Hitler also came into power by pitting rich against poor. In that case, most of the rich were cast in the role of Jews, but the Nazis did redistribute wealth after they came into power. Even though Hitler also described himself as an enemy of communism, there was very little difference between the communists and the Nazis, whose name actually includes the term National Socialist. Both parties called for wealth redistribution. The major difference was that communists expressed their convictions globally, while Nazis centered around the patriotism of their own country. Now, before somebody calls in with another comment, no, I am not comparing Obama to Hitler, at least not Hitler the mass murderer, but Hitler's early rise to power and other tactics of ambitious men with socialist agendas, absolutely, that compares to Obama. It is also a form of fascism. So if you plan to defend our president by using the name fascist to describe his opponents or to describe the previous administration, you might want to first stop, breathe, and take a moment to understand what the word actually means.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539, W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Last week, we had a caller who was part of the Hebrew Roots movement, a very nice lady. We didn't agree, but she was very friendly. She was suggesting some alternative ways to interpret some of the Apostle Paul's words about not being under the law of Moses anymore. Well, another one of my listeners mentions that he's reading a book by somebody else in the Hebrew Roots movement, and in this case, Paul's words are admitted honestly, but the book denies that Paul was inspired and claims Paul was not a true apostle of Christ. I've mentioned that the Hebrew Roots movement is very eclectic, that not all branches of it believe the same thing. So this is a branch of the Hebrew Roots movement that tries to throw Paul out altogether. Well, inasmuch as Paul penned half the books of the New Testament, look how much scripture has to be thrown out the window simply because people can't admit that we are no longer under the law. The truth is, Paul was as much of an apostle as the men who followed Jesus around for 3 years. For proof, we have only to look at the words of one of these men, Peter himself, and I'm reading from 2 Peter, his own letter. He says, "Bear in mind that our Lord's patience means salvation, just as our dear brother Paul also wrote you with the wisdom that God gave him." He writes the same way in all his letters, speaking in them of these matters. His letters contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorant and unstable people distort as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction. That was from 2 Peter chapter 3. Notice how casually Peter equates the words of Paul with scripture. As for the idea that people who distort Paul's words are ignorant and unstable, well, we'll just mercifully avoid that consideration. But understand this, if Paul was not inspired, then Peter could not have been inspired when he wrote about Paul, telling us he was inspired. And if Peter was not an apostle, nobody was an apostle. Anyway, Israel has been in the news a lot lately. If you've been following this show, you'll recall that 2 weeks ago, I had a very special guest, an Israeli named Rami Danieli. He was on the show. Now, Rami is an Israeli tour guide and former officer in the Israeli army. We talked at length about the historical revision of Israel and the Palestinians. Well, a few days before Rami came on my program, I also wrote an article for CDN, and I made very similar points. That article has received many comments, and I want to read to you a few of them. But first, let me review some of the points that were made both in the article and on our show 2 weeks ago with Rami. Now, before you accuse me of showing bias toward Israel simply because I'm Jewish, let me remind you that I'm not merely Jewish. I am a Jewish Christian. I am a Jew who converted to Christianity, and I get into sharp disagreements with fellow Jews all the time on the subject of whether or not Jesus is the Messiah. And as you heard on last week's show and these last couple of weeks, I also take great issue with fellow Jewish Christians when they say we must return to the law. So I do approach these subjects with considerable objectivity. I don't agree with somebody just because they're Jewish, but as it happens, I am with my fellow Jews when the subject of Israel comes up, because this time the Jews happen to be in the right. So let's review. Do the Jews even have a right to be in the Middle East at all? Wasn't there a group of indigenous people called the Palestinians living there since the beginning of measured history? Didn't Jews arrive after World War II and conquer the land that did not belong to them? Ladies and gentlemen, that is utterly and completely false. The Jews lived in that time, in that land, since the days of Moses, and despite some upsets from the Assyrians and Babylonians, remained in the land for many centuries until the Romans displaced them. Prince Titus and the Roman legion destroyed the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. Then in the second century, Emperor Hadrian crushed a new Jewish rebellion. This time, many of the Jews were banished, many were murdered, others were made slaves of the Romans. A small number of Jews did stay in the land and remained there right up through the 20th century. However, the name of the land at this time was changed because Hadrian wanted to destroy Jewish identity. He renamed the land Syria Palestinia. Palestinia was a Latin version of the word Philistine, an ancient enemy of the Jews who you could read about in the Old Testament and who were extinct at that time as a people. Hadrian was deliberately insulting the Jews. There has never been a country called Palestine. Let me say it again. There has never been a country called Palestine. That became a nickname for the Holy Land under the Romans, but the nick stuck. A little rhyme there. The nickname stuck. The people who today call themselves Palestinians are Arabs, and they referred to themselves as Arabs for centuries until they were dubbed Palestinians as a publicity ploy by the terrorist and founder of the PLO, Yasser Arafat, who himself was an Egyptian, incidentally, and who himself did not use the title Palestinian until after the year 1964. Okay, well, Bob, even if this is true, well then, okay, these Arabs lived in the land for centuries. Well, in ancient times, Arabs could be found in many places, but because the word Arab actually means tent dweller. But they did not occupy the Holy Land in any significant number until after the time of Muhammad in the 600s and the spread of Islam. Muslims first conquered the land from the Byzantine Church, remnants of the converted Roman Empire. Through the years, then, with crusades and other wars, the land switched ownership back and forth between the Catholic Church and the Muslims. Eventually, it fell into the hands of another Muslim empire, the Ottomans. After defeating the Ottomans in World War I, the Middle East then found itself under the domain of Great Britain. Even though the Middle East became a prize of the British Empire, England had neither the desire nor ability to run that region of the world forever. For this reason, they began working to create a series of new states in which the Arabs, who had helped them defeat the Ottoman Empire, would administer their own affairs. Although the term Arabia was already a general description for a large part of this area, many of the Middle East countries we know of today did not officially become independent nations until the British occupation and subsequent withdrawal from this turbulent region of the world. While working to create new multiple states, Great Britain, with the cooperation of the League of Nations, an early prototype of the United Nations, decided that they would also offer an opportunity for Jews all over the world to return to their homeland. This invitation was called the Balfour Declaration. Now, needless to say, grateful Jews responded with terrific enthusiasm. Indeed, many children of Abraham did migrate from Russia, Western Europe, and other corners of the globe where they had lived for some 2,000 years in ghettos at the mercy of pogroms or harsh policies of anti-Semitic governments. A homeland of their own had been a hopeful vision of the Jews for two millennia. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Sunday morning services at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock a.m. We've been talking about Israel correcting some of the historical revision, namely that the Jews went to this land illegally and occupied it. They were invited legally. It was called the Balfour Declaration by the League of Nations, prototype of the United Nations, in conjunction with Great Britain, who came into this land as a result of World War I. Not to mention the fact that the Jews had lived there for over 2,000 years before the Romans had kicked them out. So that was their land anyway. There had been a remnant of Jews still living there. But yes, they were now invited from places like Russia, Western Europe, all over the globe, where they'd been in ghettos, where they'd been recipients of harsh anti-Semitic policies, and a homeland of their own had always been a hopeful vision. The most familiar Jewish toast, as a matter of fact, very common at Passover celebrations, says next year in Jerusalem. But few thought they were reciting much more than a pipe dream. Now, they could really, truly return to Jerusalem. Just imagine how this must have felt. The Jews are going to sojourn to a country of their own, and not just any country. The very land of their ancestors, a land where a remnant of Jews had remained since ancient times, living side by side with Muslims and Christians who also had interests in Palestine and who viewed it as their holy land too. Now, what exactly was offered to the Hebrew immigrants by the League of Nations? Catch this, ladies and gentlemen. This is what was offered them. Everything we would today call Israel, everything we would today call Jordan, and most of what we would today call the occupied territories. When the Jews arrived, many of them purchased land from Arab lords. In time, a terrain that had been little more than a desolate, flea-bitten combination of swamp and desert swiftly turned green with farmland and transplanted trees. The economy also boomed, transforming this area in such an amazing way that the term metamorphosis barely does justice. New jobs were created, resulting in an influx of Arabs from other regions who now saw Palestine as a land of opportunity and employment made possible by Jewish farmers and businessmen recently arrived from Europe. What was the proportion of Arab and Jew in Palestine prior to the Balfour Declaration? More Arabs than Jews inhabited the land at this particular time in history, resulting from previous Muslim expansion. But the truth is, there was really only a handful of each people group. Because again, the swamp-like conditions had limited the kind of life one could realistically enjoy in the Holy Land. The famous author Mark Twain wrote as much after his own personal visit. He was surprised how desolate the Holy Land looked, how little was going on there, and how few people inhabited the area. All of this changed when the League of Nations invited Jews to resettle their ancient home. Ironically, it was after Jewish business created a surplus of jobs that Arabs flooded into the territory in mass, creating a situation where the Arabs greatly outnumbered the Jews. And then, in paradoxical fashion, the British, after inviting the Jews to return, sold over 75% of Palestine to the Arabs, creating a new country called Transjordan. This is an extremely important and seldom taught fact. Please catch this. 75% of what had been offered to the Jews was sold behind their backs to the Arabs. Instead, not only were the Arabs offered a separate Palestinian state long ago, but they have been living in one since the early part of the 20th century. It's called Jordan, a country three times the size of what remained for the Jews. The Jews accepted this betrayal only because they had no choice. After all, a sliver of the promise was better than no land at all, but the Arabs didn't want the Jews to have even a sliver. And fresh controversy broke out over what to do with the remaining 25%. To appease the Arabs, the United Nations, which had now taken over, voted to divvy up the remaining 25% between the Jews and the Arabs. The Jews accepted this partition. The Arabs did not. After the partition vote from the United Nations, Israel declared its independence and became a legal nation on May 14th, 1948. One day later, five Arab countries invaded Israel from Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Important note, please write this down. This war had nothing to do with allowing a two-state solution. Indeed, the Arabs waged war because they were rejecting a two-state solution. Their stated goal was the complete extermination of Israel. You don't believe me? Well, catch this. This is from the King of Saudi Arabia in 1947. There are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million people to kill all of the Jews? The price is worth it. This is from the Secretary General of the Arab League in 1947. This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres. And this is from the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in 1947. I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews. Murder them all. Jews pleaded with Palestinian Arabs to remain in their homes. Although many of the Arabs did flee or join the invading armies, a considerable portion of Arabs remained in Israel. This interesting fact is seldom discussed. About 300,000 Arabs fled Israel, but about 160,000 Arabs remained in Israel. They became citizens of Israel. You don't have to be Jewish to be a citizen of Israel. Today, Israel still contains a vital Arab population, and these Arabs have more rights in Israel than any Arab in any Arab country, unless it's the Sheikh or something. In fact, shortly before Yasser Arafat's death, when there was talk once again under the Bush administration of a separate Palestinian state, the Arab citizens in Israel were asked by the Israeli government if they wanted to move to the new country of Palestine, renounce their Israeli citizenship, and live in the Palestinian sector. Guess what they decided? Some of them probably fell on the floor laughing before saying to the Israeli government, "Oh, I'm sorry, you were serious." In 1948, when Israel beat the odds and defeated five invading nations, the problem of refugees came up. We always hear about the Arab refugees from Israel, but they were not the only refugees, folks. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were kicked out of Arab lands too. All, and I mean all, of the Jewish refugees were welcomed into Israel, whereas Arabs who wanted to resettle into Arab countries were, for the most part, denied admission. Jordan was an exception, but even in Jordan, most of the refugees were confined to camps. They lived in that condition all the way up to 1967, when at that time Israel annexed Jordan's West Bank because Jordan was about to attack Israel. Prior to 1967, there was no significant ongoing discussion amongst the countries of the world regarding Jordan's treatment of the poor Palestinians. On December 11, 1948, the United Nations drafted and ratified Resolution 194 that had to do with refugees and how to handle them. And we'll talk about that resolution when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
On December 11, 1948, the United Nations drafted and ratified Resolution 194. This was a call for the Arab states in Israel to resolve the refugee settlement issues, but the condition was that all returning citizens would agree to live in peace. Receiving no such guarantee from the Arabs, Israel decided to postpone repatriation until her neighbors would recognize her right to exist. Never happened. In 1967, nine different nations, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq declared war on Israel and promised to exterminate every Jew. I'm reading from Radio Cairo, May 17, 1967. Egypt is ready to plunge into a total war that will be the end of Israel. But surprising the world with a preemptive strike after these braggarts said exactly what they were planning to do, Israel defeated the Arabs in just 6 days. At that time, their territory was expanded to the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai, and the remainder of Jerusalem, half of which had been taken over by Jordan after the 1947 war. This territory is frequently referred to as part of Israel's illegal occupation. I hate that term and argue against it for the following reasons. One, when we think of occupying countries, what usually comes to mind is an aggressive empire seeking to conquer and expand, not a tiny little nation that expanded its borders only as a means of survival to prevent her untrustworthy neighbors from attacking again. Two, most of this land had been legally offered to Israel in the Balfour Declaration anyway, before Great Britain sold it behind Israel's back. Three, historically, the land had been the home of the Jews for literally thousands of years. Four, the United Nations has become corrupt, raising questions about their standards as to what is legal or illegal. This is not to say that Israel has not given back land or made peace treaties. The Sinai has been returned, and other territories have been slowly transferred to the Palestinian authorities. But ladies and gentlemen, when two nations make a peace treaty, they're supposed to be give and take, something for both sides. Israel's deal, brokered by the United States, always goes like this. You give the Palestinians back some land, and, well, here is what they will do. They'll promise to stop killing you. That's the deal. And then shortly after the deal, the promise is broken anyway, and missiles are fired into Israel from Gaza, where the Palestinians were finally offered their own autonomous rule, or a suicide bomber kills women and children on a bus. Nothing Israel does, no gesture, no concession, no discussion will make a hill of beans of difference. They can sign a peace treaty. They can jump on board for a two-state solution. They can stand on their heads. It doesn't matter. Hezbollah wants Israel dead. Al-Qaeda wants Israel dead. Hamas wants Israel dead. Muslim Brotherhood wants Israel dead. But it isn't limited to the terrorist groups. Palestine itself wants Israel dead, has never recognized its right to exist. The surrounding Arab nations want Israel dead. The Persian nation of Iran wants Israel dead. My advice to Israel, just do what you have to do. Do what you need to do. Do what is right. The world will hate you no matter what action you take. And the Arabs will try to kill you no matter how much flowery talk you participate in with our idiotic State Department. You may as well just do what's right. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious. Well, we have some more comments now. I told you I wanted to read some comments. This was all, again, we talked about this 2 weeks ago with an Israeli guest, but this was also published in my column, Forbidden Table Talk. Hamal says this, Jewish babble with no facts. Canaanites were there before the Jews, and the Jews decided to wage war against them because they believed they had a stake to that land, which they don't. Common sense will tell you that the ancient Jews were psychotic to think that God gave them the land. Okay, before I look at Hamal's points, I want to respond to his phrase, Jewish babble. Let's be clear. Had he written black babble, had he written Hispanic babble, had he written Asian babble, people would jump all over it and call it racism. But they never do that when they say Jewish babble. I guess it's always open season on the Jews. Start talking about Israel and the anti-Semitic snakes crawl out from under the rocks. Start talking about Israel and the anti-Semitic pigs come out of the woodwork. As for it being psychotic to think God gave them the land, God gave them the land, and he gave them the reason, because the Canaanites were taking live babies and murdering them on the altar to their gods, gods such as Baal. Now, either way, this has nothing to do with the fact that the Jews did live in that land for well over 1,000 years before being displaced by the Romans, and all of that happened before Arabs came to the land. The land certainly never belonged to a group of people called the Palestinians. Now, Christie says this. She says, the Jews in Israel have not really won a war on their own. The truth is, after World War II, masses of Jewish people needed a place to go, so it was decided that they occupy the area now known as Israel. Christie, that's utter nonsense. And I disproved all of that in my article which you wrote a comment on at the bottom. There was no occupation. The land was theirs historically. A remnant still lived there over all those years. Their return to the land was due to a legal invitation. Christy, did you actually read the article, or are you just emotionally reacting? Now, this guy over the internet has a nickname called Now is the Best. Now is the Best says that we can criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic. Well, my friend, that all depends on what that means. If you're taking the side of Hamas, or the side of Palestinians who are Well, then you're taking the side of people who simply deny Israel's right to exist and whose history has shown an attempt to wipe out every Jewish man, woman, and child. If that's not anti-Semitism, what is? To support such people is anti-Semitic at the very least. In fact, anti-Semite is the nicest thing you can call that viewpoint. Scorpion terrorists with genocide agenda would be a more accurate description. On the other hand, I realize that most who criticize Israel simply have no idea that her enemies are uninterested in a two-state solution and simply want Israel dead. So no, those people are not necessarily anti-Semitic, just ignorant. But it's a dangerous ignorance, and we need to speak out against it. Well, Jesse, on the other hand, liked what I said. He simply wrote truth. Well, Jesse, you show wisdom beyond your years. This next fellow calls himself Mazaroth. He didn't show quite as much wisdom as Jesse. He says, that has to be the most biased, deceitful, and misleading history lesson ever. Whoa, easy thing to say, buddy. You are welcome to call my radio show and tell me where I am going wrong. I don't believe I will be hearing from you. By the way, I wrote that same invitation to him under his comment by that column several weeks ago. I can't help but notice that he never called in. The guy is popping off at the mouth. He doesn't have a clue what he's talking about, but like most people, that doesn't stop him. God predicted this phenomenon years ago in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 18:2. The fool isn't interested in learning, only in expressing his opinion. But Roxy liked the article. She says, thanks for this article, Mr. Siegel. I recently took a religious studies course on Eastern religious traditions where I studied many of these facts. Boy, they taught a fact at a university? go figure. Anyway, she says, I appreciate how you wrote such complex information in a way that is clear and easy for people to understand. Maybe they will take it from here and study the facts for themselves, hopefully from scholarly sources. It's amazing the way I have seen some bloggers put a spin on history. If it wasn't so sad and disturbing, it would be laughable. That it would be, Roxy. Jacob writes, very informative. I am left with the feeling that the problem cannot be solved by force, nor by peaceful negotiation, but that everyone unfortunate to be in that part of the world is terribly unlucky. From my distant point of view, all I see is hatred at work. Sort of the opposite of, like, say, for instance, the teachings of Buddha or the Dalai Lama. Well, yeah, those sound like more peaceful religions. But sometimes, Jacob, my friend, when two people are having a dispute, it's always easy to assume that both sides are partly right and partly wrong. We're looking at one of those cases where somebody just is in the wrong. The people following Moses are not in the wrong. The people that are following Muhammad are in the wrong. I'm sorry. I'm not here to be politically correct. I have no desire to have a politically correct radio show. Just want to speak the truth. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.